come join the conversation, the show that you've been wanting. Keep it real with no filter, weekly we share discussions. WWSD, interviewing creative guests, talking the creative process and sharing all the influences from TV and film. Emmy nominated and winning, yeah, they coming through. Actors and comedians too, directors and writers, way more than a few. Masters of their craft, yes, tune in, you gotta see. This the podcast that you need, WWSD.
Welcome to the WWSD podcast. Weekly, we share discussions with interesting and creative people. I'm your host, Josh, and as always, I'm joined by my buddy and co-host, Seamus. How you doing, Seamus?
Doing great, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Doing good tonight, huh?
Yeah.
Who do we have on?
Tonight, we have a very, very special guest. We are joined by Larry Wilson. Larry co-wrote and produced one of my all-time favorite movies, Beetlejuice. He also co-wrote the Addams Family movie, The Little Vampire, and many more. He also wrote and directed Tales from the Crypt for 6 seasons, and absolute pleasure having you on the podcast tonight, Larry. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for creating stuff that are like so heavily invested in my childhood. Like,
yeah, oh my God. Yeah.
I don't know if that's good or bad, but
like, hey, well, I hear it more and more, honestly. Yeah, your childhood was my adulthood, but good. I'm happy I could help.
everything I love could definitely be traced back to you and your work to some degree.
Hey, okay, so good.
So how'd you get started writing for TV and film?
Well, I had passion/obsession for horror when I was growing up. And I moved to Los Angeles when I was 17 with some notion of wanting to be in the film business and wanting to do, still trying to figure it out, but something that was based in horror. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I actually took a writing class. And the teacher looked at some work I turned in and he said, you're good at this. I think you could do this. Yeah, you know, and it was a light bulb moment. I was not a good student. No one in my high school was thinking, oh, that Larry Wilson, he's going places. Believe me, it was kind of the opposite. But I had that one person, and which I think is so huge for people, who said, I think you could do this. And it just, he lit me up where I started writing. And it really began there.
What do you think it was about your writing in particular that made you stand out?
I have a way with words. I'm not going to, no false modesty about it. I write good sentences. I write colorful sentences. I write sentences people want to read. And I've been able to adapt that to film writing. I think my scripts are good, but they're readable, you know, because I was a script reader for, oh my God, I want to say close to 10 years. And you read so many scripts that are just flat. Every once in a while, you read a great one. Then you read scripts that are so terrible, they're kind of fun, you know, but the majority of them are in the bland middle. And you try reading 5-6 of those a week and your brain starts running out of your ears. So I've always tried to give my scripts like a sense of color and vibrancy and make them where they pop off the page a little bit. And I think that's part of what I've done well, done right.
And was that like a natural thing for you, or did you have to do a lot of work to get that way?
Well, to refine it, I had to do a lot of work. It was always, you know, there in some form. And, you know, and I was very lucky. My mother was a passionate reader and she really taught me a love of reading. I was reading sort of above my age from the time I was 6-7 years old. And I think that helped. You know, I was reading Ray Bradbury and great, you know, like science fiction and just prose that really, it needed to be visual. You know, Bradbury was an incredibly visual writer. I think he was the biggest influence on me. And I think that helped.
It's interesting. I imagine visual writing that's pretty much what writing a screenplay is, right?
Yeah, it is. And what happens with my scripts, and I just finished a script today, a round of applause for me because it's been in the works for a while. But when the first draft was like 147 pages long, it was 30 plus pages too long for a script that's going on the marketplace. But it needed to be because I'm writing and I'm working through visuals and I'm telling the story to myself and working through the visuals. Then my job is to go back through and hone it down and edit it down. And it landed at a kind of a great 115 pages today. So that's an exciting process.
And from that process, like, are you like just keep revisioning it and cutting it more, or are you done with it at that point?
it's where it needs to be. I have a couple of people in the business who I trust to kind of read my first drafts if I want them to. They all said, it's really good. It's really you, which is nice to hear, but it's just way too long. And they were right. And now it's sort of exactly where it needs to be. 115, that's a very good length. And I've just got to go through it and like proofread it one more time. And then it goes into the marketplace and I have a nervous breakdown. That's how that works. And I decide everyone loves me or everyone hates me, depending on the mood I'm in. Yeah.
Are you one of those guys that like kind of submit it and then it's just out of your head? You're like, all right, I got to move to the next project.
I do that out of pure survival. I was telling a friend today that I've already got the next one lined up and I'm researching it. And does that make me like, oh, God, he's so dedicated and, he's always writing? Well, I suppose in some sense that's true. But if I'm working on the next one and this one fails, I can tell myself, well, the next one will succeed. Yeah. So it's survival instinct a lot of the time.
And you mentioned when you're younger, you're really into horror. What was it about horror that really got you in a creative space like that?
I don't go into detail about this, and I'm sure you'll understand, but I had a pretty scary childhood. And I think that horror became an inoculation, honestly, that it was a place that I could take whatever those childhood fears were, put them on a movie or put them on a book or put them on a comic book. And they could live there and kind of be purged from me. And I think if we looked at a lot of horror writers, there's some version of that that went on in their life, I'm guessing.
Were there any particular like movies or franchises from when you were growing up that you really gravitated towards?
Well, the one I always have to talk about, because it was, I think, the one that really inspired me, like maybe 9, 10 years old, to think, oh, I've got to do something in some version of a horror movie in a very naive way. I was thinking about it was The Bride of Frankenstein.
Okay.
And it is, without a doubt, my all time favorite movie, always was, always will be. And there was way back in the day on Los Angeles television on Saturday nights, there was something called Shock Theater. The host came out in a coffin. Yep. and introduced the movies. Great. And what it was that Universal had sold a package of all the Universal horror films to television. And every city in the country had some version of Shock Theater. And I loved all those Universal horror movies and still do, honestly. But Bride of Frankenstein really stood out. It just popped for me. I saw it. I was really lucky. I saw it a few years ago, finally on a theater screen, on a big screen with a very pristine print. And it's every bit as good and as audacious, as original as I've always thought it was. And that was the one. That was the one that I just went, wow, okay, this is my world. I'll tell you a very quick, funny anecdote about that. It became such an obsession that when Beetlejuice became like this surprise hit, which it was a surprise, my mother said to me, Larry, I always thought all he ever wants to think about is Frankenstein, but he's my son. He's going to be okay. And that became such a huge thing in my life. And I said, well, Mom, I think you were right. It was galvanizing. I don't know how else to put it. It meant that much to me.
And that's interesting because like the whole Universal monster franchise is kind of like taking a dip. Like those movies don't really exist anymore. From like such a fan of it and such an influence on you. Is that hard at all, seeing those movies just kind of disappear?
They haven't disappeared for me. When I said that I saw it on a big screen, The Bride of Frankenstein, I was teaching. I teach a horror and fantasy workshop. I know we're going to talk about my teaching later. And I had gone to see it. And some of my students showed up because I rant and rave about that movie so much. And I didn't even know they were coming. It wasn't like I invited them. They just showed up because they'd heard me talking about it so much. The screening was over. They all came up to me and said, wow, you're right. That's an amazing movie. And, are the Universal horror movies terrifying anymore? Well, no. Are some of them, particularly later in the franchise, are they, campy and a bit tacky? Yes. But the good ones are still really good. And I just do my little bit whenever I have a chance to speak up for them. But particularly like the Bride of Frankenstein, if anyone were to see one of them, that's the one to see.
Yeah, because like even like horror kind of like just completely like taking a complete turn from like that style of like the actual monsters and stuff. Like now it's more like man's the ultimate monster and all that.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's a lot more gore now too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I wrote for Tales from the Crypt for 6 seasons and mm-hmm. I shed a lot of blood on Tales from the Crypt. But gore is easy, and doing something that has depth of character, I'm going to be highfalutin about this, but some sort of a moral intent, like The Bride of Frankenstein. The Bride of Frankenstein, one of the big themes in it is it's we humans who are the monsters. Yep. The monster is a victim. Look, there's some really outstanding, terrific horror films being made now, and the genre, I think because it's being taken more seriously, which sometimes is a good thing, sometimes a bad thing. The fact that those movies are outlaw movies is part of what makes them important, you know, that they're out of the mainstream. But gore for gore's sake, I'm not so into. And it's just been done. I mean, yeah. You know, I don't know how many more ways you can slaughter a human being.
You worked on Alfred Hitchcock Presents as well.
That was an interesting one because, you know, there was Alfred Hitchcock had an anthology show, maybe started in the late 50s, ran into the 60s. And great. I mean, a lot of really terrific, you know, half hour stories in, you know, the way that the Twilight Zone was an anthology show and then Tales from the Crypt would become an anthology show. And Alfred Hitchcock introduced every one of the episodes. And his introductions are often more than half the fun. They're amazing. And so Universal decided that they were going to do the new Alfred Hitchcock show, and they were going to colorize his introductions. And then he would say goodnight also. They were going to colorize, though, and then create new episodes around. And who would become my Beetlejuice writing partner, Michael McDowell, and I were tapped to write an episode called The Jar, which was based on a Ray Bradbury story, which was very exciting for me. I actually got to meet him late in his life and tell him about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was. That was an amazing experience. But anyway, but yeah, so they did the colorized introduction, and Mike and I wrote a new version of a Hitchcock episode called The Jar that Tim Burton directed, and that was our first time we worked with Tim. And I've watched it relatively recently. I found it. It kind of disappeared. I found it on YouTube, and I actually really liked it. It's very 80s.
Yeah.
You know, the hair, the shoulder pads, the, you know, all of that. But I was really happy with it, and I could see Tim becoming Tim in it, and then Michael and I could see us starting to vibe together and stuff we were doing. And yeah, that was a fun, and it was amazing to have something that I can say, oh, I'm sorry, it was introduced by Alfred Hitchcock. You know, I'm not bragging, but.
And so you said you kind of lucked out to kind of get into the industry, but what were you doing at the time, like to try and like present yourself to seize those opportunities?
Oh my God. It's almost embarrassing to say right now, but I was sort of that doofus that would go to the guard gate of a movie studio and talk to the guy, lift the berry up and down and say, shucks, I want to be in the movie business. Do you know what I could do, sir? I mean, I just was just that person, and I was, you know, throwing myself at it. And then I caught this huge break. My mother owned a beauty shop, and you're going to, what does this have to do with movies? But I'll explain. And my job was to clean the shop every night. I can sweep hair better than anyone I know, and then restock like all the makeup and all of the, you know, like just kind of put the shop back together for her at the end of the night. And so I moved to LA and I got a job in a department store, and I got put on the makeup counter. And I said to the woman who ran the makeup counter, your stock room's a mess. I can clean it up for you. And I did. And oh, she was so grateful. And she started talking to me. What do you want to do? I want to be in the movie business. I'm not sure. And she introduced me to Barney McNulty. And if you look him up, if you Google Barney McNulty, he basically invented the cue card. And I went from stocking makeup almost literally overnight to like running rehearsal cards on the Academy Awards. It was crazy.
That's cool.
And then, you know, that got me on sound stages, and it just all sort of grew from there. But I mean, that was just a huge break. And I was always so grateful to Barney for hiring me, because he really opened a door to what was going to be the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It's interesting the things that you do when you're young end up like having such a big effect on your success that you might not have the audacity to do when you're older. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. You grow into your self-consciousness, unfortunately. where?
How far into this journey where did you take that writing class?
Oh, not that far, honestly. I think I'd probably been in Los Angeles and I was working doing cue cards. So I want to say I'd been there in like maybe 2.5-3 years. And it was just a standalone class. There was a very famous acting teacher named Stella Adler, and she had a studio in Los Angeles. And for some reason, they offered us 10-12-week screenwriting class that I took. And like I say, the teacher, whose name I should remember off the top of my head, but I don't, you know, just said something nice about what he'd read, and that lit the fuse. My next big job was I became a story analyst, you know, reading scripts. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those where I asked a dumb question and got a good answer and got sent to American International Pictures, home of Roger Corman, you know, the Vincent Price horror movies and all of that. They were a little bit on their last legs when I started reading for them, you know, reading scripts. And I started writing seriously, and I sold something, and it was incredibly exciting, but the end result was not exciting at all. The project crashed and burned in a way that, of course, I felt was unfair. And I kept writing, but this is something I talk to my students about all the time. I mean, to be honest about it, I suffered a real case of writer's block, and where I just couldn't deliver anymore, I felt. But I had a golden door out of screenwriting because I was working as a story analyst at Paramount Pictures. And Jeff Katzenberg, particularly, you know, who went out to be the president of Disney and found DreamWorks and all of that, he really liked my story notes. And I got a chance to audition to become a studio executive, and I got the job. And so I was no longer writing screenplays. I was telling writers how to write screenplays, you know, in my new job, which eventually became a very uncomfortable fit for me, quite honestly. But then Walter Hill was making 48 hours at Paramount at that time. And I got to know Walter, and he was starting a new company at Universal. And he said, come over and work for me, which I did. My job was to find a writer for Aliens, the Alien sequel. And I can say that I, quote unquote, discovered James Cameron for Alien.
That's awesome.
And brought him into it. But I also say about that, and that is true, actually. It was me who brought Jim Cameron into that project. But what I always say about, if you had my job and you met Jim Cameron and you didn't know he was going to be the James Cameron, you didn't deserve my job. Right, I mean, right. he was just, there was ever a no-brainer.
I heard that you had some pushback about him too, and that you were kind of paramount in like getting him through.
But there was some pushback. Walter was shooting a movie because Walter Hill and my other boss there, a man named David Giler, produced and written, I believe, with Dan O'Bannon, the first movie. And I was so excited about Jim Cameron, but Walter was shooting a movie called Streets of Fire that was having huge production problems. So it was very hard to get his attention. Jim, at that point, Terminator, I forget where it was, but it was either in post-production but it wasn't there. The script was. But Jim had one movie, like Piranha 2, that we could screen. And you didn't look at Piranha 2 and go, oh, my God, you know, it's the next great auteur. And there was a little bit of pushback. My card was, I just said, read Terminator. That script just screamed hit movie, just screamed it, and was written with just an energy. Well, you know, I mean, that's a writer who can put himself on the page. And that was, you know, I think that finally sealed the deal. But I didn't find just the writer for Aliens. I found the writer and director. And fought for him and won, helped him. Not saying I got him the job, I helped him. I started sort of having this very sort of empty feeling, honestly. I was missing writing, and I felt I just kind of, I'd sold myself short as a writer way too soon. And that led to Beetlejuice, and Beetlejuice was the one that sold. And that was the one that, you know, really kickstarted my writing career.
So when you were an exec, you weren't doing any writing, or were you like doing a little bit of writing on the side?
I had, pre-computers, I actually had a Rolodex with some ideas in it. But that, to be a paramount executive under Jeff Katzenberg, you were literally working like 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. All those apocryphal stories about him getting in at, you know, 7 a.m. and feeling the hood of your car to see if the engine was warm because you were supposed to have been in earlier, they're true. But at the same time, he was an amazing boss. But I had an idea, and we were under incredible pressure. We had a Monday morning meeting where we were supposed to bring in ideas. And I had one that I wanted to write called Young Sherlock Holmes. But I was desperate for an idea, and I went in and pitched it on a Paramount Monday morning meeting. And Jeff said, it's a great idea. If Chris Columbus will write it, you know, we'll do it. And so I gave away like a really good idea that was going to be mine. And it was just one of those moments where then I was telling myself, no, this is my new job. This is what I do now. But that one stung, honestly. And so it was just kind of like a buildup. And then, I mean, meeting Jim Cameron and spending some time with him and seeing that creative fire, I miss that side of things. And I wanted to be a writer again. And I met my writing partner, Michael McDowell, my producing partner, my Beetlejuice producing partner, Michael Bender. And we started to work on Beetlejuice.
So being an executive, that probably gave you more of an insight into how to write a script in a way that will be attractive to people that are in the industry.
Definitely. And being a story analyst and reading hundreds and hundreds of just mediocre scripts, that gave me an insight. But it also gave me an insight on how to save your script when it enters place to screenwriters called development hell, where you're rewriting and rewriting and rewriting until you forget sort of what you started with.
Yeah, that's interesting because Beetlejuice at the time was very innovative, different, and unique compared to anything that had been done before. Did you have difficulty selling that?
Well, this is a story I have to tell you since you asked that question. I don't name names in a story like this because it's a little bit throwing someone under a bus. But a very, very powerful Universal executive liked me and liked my work. And when we finished, we being Michael McDowell and I finished the first draft of Beetlejuice. I said, well, I'm going to give it to him to read. Why not? And he said, of course, I'll read it. Great. I gave it to him on a Friday. I got a call from his office on Monday morning that he wanted to meet with me. And I thought, oh, my God, we've done it. You know, he so loved it that he doesn't even want it on the marketplace. Universal is going to buy it. You know, don't show it to anyone else. And I went to his office and he literally said to me, Larry, what are you doing with this piece of shit? he said, you have a future in this business. You have a great reputation. You're known for, you know, having a really great story sense. This thing is going to ruin your career. It's weird. He just went on and he actually thought that he was helping me. Gotten by saying you should put it in a drawer and forget about it. Well, you know, he was wrong.
Yeah.
Which it has something that I've kind of carried with me that people in power can be wrong about your work, which is a nice thing to know sometimes. But that script and the movie itself had that reaction until it became such a huge hit and it kind of came out of nowhere. And then there were a lot of people who were, which always happens, you know, taking credit where if the truth be told.
After he kind of rejected your script and told you kind of shelve it, like, did you disagree with him right away and start like going to other other studios?
This is part two of the story. Okay. This is a good story. And this is a good story for all the film students out there. I had started teaching. I've been teaching screenwriting for like 30 plus years now. And I was teaching at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, the screenwriting extension program. And I was teaching a class in story analysis. And I had a student, if she's out there somewhere, I always say she's one of the unsung heroes of Beetlejuice, a student named Marjorie Lewis. And she was just kind of the smartest girl in the class. And she had a very low level job, creative executive job at the Geffen company. And I left that meeting with the all-powerful Universal executive. And I got to admit, it devastated me. It gutted me. And I was going to call my partner and talk to him about it, but I needed some time, you know, to process. but I'd given it to Marjorie to read the same Friday. And I thought, out of desperation, I'm going to call Marjorie. And I was half expecting her to say, I don't know, Larry, I'm so sorry. You're a great teacher. But but I called her and I said, Marjorie, did you read it? She said, yes. I said, did you like it? And she said, like it. I'm going to get the Geffen Company to buy it. And I know exactly what she did because she was a tenacious young woman. She just kept putting it on people's desk and saying, did you read it? Did you read it? Did you read it? And so they all said, shut up, Marjorie, we'll read it. That got it into the Geffen Company, and the Geffen Company bought it, and they bought it for our asking price. And I don't know if it ever would have gotten there without Marjorie. My student really opened that door, which is kind of cool.
Actually. Really cool. It's another audacious young person. Huh?
Yeah, she was. Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. She was that person. Yeah.
After they bought your script, what kind of happens from the writer's perspective after that point? Are you kind of done with it? Is it theirs? Do they do their own thing? Or were you still involved in the process?
Michael and I, we sold it to the Geffen Company. We ended up writing probably 8-9 drafts of it until we honestly felt that we had pretty much ruined it. But then because we had had this relationship with Tim Burton, Tim had read it the very first draft and said, I love it. I'd like to do it. But he had another project he thought was lined up and that was going to go. Well, that had fallen through. And Tim said, well, I want to do it, but I want to say it needs to go back to some version of the draft that you showed me, the first draft, which is what happened. A writer named, it's so sad because both Michael McDowell, my writing partner, then a writer named Warren Scarron, who came in and did a really great, respectful rewrite. We were honestly sort of persona non grata, however you say that, with the Geffen Company at that time. Never anything to do with David Geffen, by the way. I don't think he was part of this development hell we got into. But both Michael McDowell and Warren Scarron died very young and very tragically. So I'm always sort of careful about the stories I tell about Beetlejuice because there's no one to refute me, if you know what I mean. So, oh God, I hate to think how far back it is now. So this is all my memories of it. And I try to be very scrupulous about what I know I did on it and what Michael and I did on it. But when Tim came on and said, it's got to go back to what I had read in the beginning, it got back there. Then it was just lightning in a bottle. Everything just came together in this extraordinary way. But 8 drafts, and that was where me having been a studio executive, I'm a producer on Beetlejuice, and that's where I earned my producer stripes because I knew how to play that game of development chess and give a little away to get something back. Again, it finally, though, there was so much of it. It was just overwhelming, the process. But I kept us in the game for 8 drafts until something great happened.
I'm kind of wondering, since you've been an executive and you played the other side, you always hear all these horror stories about executives not understanding the creative vision of the creative people that are involved and
just care about the dollar signs.
Yeah, there are a lot of projects that could have been great. They got messed up because people that weren't creatives get their hands in there and kind of screw it up. And I imagine that for most executives, there are times when they've kind of messed something up, but there's also times when they really made something great. You know, so it's there's probably kind of a balance there. I'm wondering what your opinion is on all of that. You know, what do executives do good? Where do they fall short?
Well, you know, I actually, everyone has a podcast. Most of them don't do it as well as you guys. Yeah. And why should I be different? And I'm just started thinking, I'd like to do a podcast with those kind of middle level development executives, because they are so, you know, writers love to tell horror stories about how these executives, you know, screwed up their scripts, screwed up their lives, you know, and yeah, it's happened. I've got some good development horror stories, but I've also have some executives or creative executives I've worked with, development people who have been incredibly helpful and had great ideas. And, you know, talking about my overlong screenplay that I just finished, one of the people who gave me insights into it is an executive named Kevin Nicholas, who's at a company called Tapas now. And he read it and he gave me such great notes and kind of opened my eyes about where it could get cut, how I could reshape it, what I could lose and all of that. He made such a difference to me going back into it and figuring out how to get it like at a manageable length. Look, writers are sensitive souls and they have thin skins, right? And it's so easy sometimes to blame the executive, blame the director, blame the actor, and as opposed to maybe blaming yourself. Sometimes writers are very capable of messing it up on their own. It's a movie business cliche. And yes, I've had some horror show development experience, some meetings where I sat there across the desk, smiling, waving my arms, doing my song and dance, thinking you people are idiots, in my mind.
It's interesting too, because the first executive that you took that to, that was someone you respected, that was someone that that had a big track record, but they thought that script wasn't going to work, but it did end up work. I'm wondering how often do those things kind of fall through the cracks? So that, I imagine there are a lot of really crappy scripts that get denied made. And they absolutely or they get made, but yeah. Even like the crappy scripts do get denied, and like I'm wondering if like that probably happens more often than not, whereas like yours was probably a rare occurrence where something that could have been a hit was kind of denied.
No one really knows what's going to work, what's not going to work. I mean, yeah, you can identify things that are just bad, right? You can identify things that have potential greatness in them. The last thing I ever read as a story analyst was the galleys, the pre-publication galleys of Silence of the Lambs. And I said in my, I wish I had copies of that coverage still. I said in my coverage, if handled right, this can win an Academy Award. I don't know how I figured that out, but it just, you read something like that and and when I read Terminator, this thing was going hit movie, game changer. When I read the first draft at Paramount of 48 hours, same thing, but like with 48 hours, what did it invent? Well, it invented like the buddy cop genre, like a staple of Hollywood ever since. It introduced Eddie Murphy to the screen. I go on and on about that movie, but there were executives at Paramount that thought it was just off the rails terrible. They couldn't understand like how you could combine real violence, Walter Hill violence, people getting blown away with large handguns, with comedy. They didn't get it. It hadn't been done. Now it's done all the time. And there's some sort of gut instinct that people have about what will work and what won't work. And there's no logic to it. You just feel it. And in a script, you feel it on the page.
I imagine that they're probably like good ideas that they get put into a bad story structure and they don't work.
Yeah.
Or like a good idea that has a good story structure, but there isn't good execution on the directing and the filming. It doesn't work. And there are probably things that are a little bit more mediocre, but the execution is great, and it kind of passes. So it seems like there's a lot of things that have to fall into place to make something really good.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I saw a movie, The Lost City, recently, Sandra Bullock, the other guy. and that movie does not have an original bone in its body. But is it very well made? Is it slick? Is it entertaining? Does it pass 2 hours happily? Yeah, it does. It works. It's not going to go down in the history of cinema. But there are those movies, and God bless them. They keep people, coming to the movie theaters. And then, there are the really audacious, movies, the Charlie Kaufman's of the world. The movie that I keep raving about now is Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
I've heard great things about that.
For me, it was fantastic. I watched it in a movie theater, and half the audience was like, wow, we've just seen something really special. And half the audience was like, what the fuck? it's that movie. But it's made $50 million on something like a $20 million budget. I think a lot of people would have read that script or seen that film about maybe thinking to pick it up and distribute it and go, no way. It's too bizarre. But you have a feeling sometimes, and I think it's best to trust that feeling.
I mean, did you find that you became less critical to like scripts after like with Beetlejuice, because you were kind of shot down initially? I mean, were you a little bit more like giving to like writers evaluating what they had after that experience?
Oh boy, that's a very good question. No, because when I worked at Paramount, studio politics can be very Machiavellian and very political. And I was horrible at that stuff. I had had an experience with a fellow executive who had just like basically stolen a project from me that I really wanted to work on, just outran me, outmanipulated me. And I went to Jeff and I was angry and I was very frustrated. He said, Larry, you need to learn to be a straight player in a crooked game. You are never going to be a politician in this business. What I like about you and why you're valuable to me is when you love something, you really love it and you're passionate about it. And when you find something, you know, a script or a book or something, and you're going to come in with a lot of passion and a lot of belief in it. And that's what I need you around here for. That was such an incredible thing to say to me at that moment. And it really stuck with me. And I think all Beetlejuice did because it was, you know, and this unnamed executive, he was more than entitled to his opinion. But I think it more made me just really respect that one of a kind moment, that one of a kind thing that when you read it or you saw it, you went, wow, this has something. I've always looked for something new, something a bit different.
And did the exec ever apologize to you or say he was wrong?
Oh, no. Please,
of course
please,
not.
Please. Yeah. He forgot the meeting 10 minutes after I left the room, you know, and thought he had set me straight and set me on my way. And then it was next. Yeah.
That's funny. Where did that passion from teaching come from? Like, you seem very passionate about it. It's something that you said you've done it for over 30 years. I mean, where did that kind of come from?
You know, I didn't know I had it in me till I did it. When I was going to become a studio executive, you know, when you're a writer, you're isolated most of the time, you're insulated, you're in your own world, in your own room. And I just had a feeling, I said, if I'm going to do this job and I'm going to be meeting with, you know, writer after writer and have to be out there, I should probably do something to get rid of the introverted Larry and bring out the extroverted Larry. And I thought, well, maybe teaching. And I went to the UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles Extension, Screenwriting Extension Program, and talked to them about teaching a story analysis class. And I got the job. And the first night I was going to teach, I prepared, rehearsed, got in front of a class of 30 people, and everything went out of my head.
Of course.
Just like, it felt like an hour. I just stood there staring at these people. And then finally some survival mechanism went off and I said, I got to start talking. And I just found, you know, I couldn't speak and now you can't shut me up when I'm teaching. So I just grew into it. And I did find I had a gift for it. Screenwriting is an art. Teaching is an art. And one thing that I've been able to provide, well, a lot of experience, you know, like this is a mean, sarcastic thing to say, and that's why I'm going to say it. The difference between me and a lot of screenwriting teachers is I'm actually a successful screenwriter. And, you know, and I sometimes say that, well, you throw a brick in Hollywood and you can hit a screenwriting teacher. And the thing that separates me out, dear audience, the WilsonWorkshop.com is where all of this teaching experience is going to go now. But I do think the fact that I'm a working screenwriter, I'm still doing it, it's a tremendous help to me. And the teaching's always fed my screenwriting, and the screenwriting's always fed my teaching. Because when I have to go, and the classes I'm going to be doing now at the WilsonWorkshop.com, you know, they're all going to be by Zoom. And I've got to be able to reach out to a digital room full of Zoom, you know, Zoom faces, and bring them into, you know, a teaching experience. And there is an art to it, and there's a gift. And I think one thing, well, I'm going to be teaching screenwriting workshops. I'm going to be teaching one to Beetlejuice. I'm going to be teaching one to the Addams Family. I'm going to be teaching a screenwriting basics weekend workshop. Going to be a lot of range of classes. But one of the things that I'm really excited that I'm going to be doing, and it's something that I've done, you know, I mean, my job as a studio tech, it was basically writing script notes. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be working, doing consultations with writers, different levels where, you know, I will give notes. And I think I give great notes on their screenplays and in-depth notes. But the other thing that I do, this comes from my students who have worked with me, is I inspire them. I give them some confidence. When I start my classes, I say 95% of you will fail. It's the first thing I say. And people are going, I paid for this to be told that I'm a failure. But I say 95% of you will fail because 95% of you will never finish your screenplay. It's just a sad truth. People get to about page 60 and then they figure out a way not to finish. And I think I inspire people creatively, but I think I also inspire them to hang in there and finish. And one of the things I'm going to be doing, and this is going to be the first time I'm doing it, but it's something that I've always thought about as a screenwriting teacher. I'm going to be doing a mentoring program where I'm going to take a select group of students. They're going to have to audition. I'm going to have to see some work of theirs and work with them for a year with weekly check-ins, notes, and truly like mentor them and you know, creatively hold their hand through an entire screenplay.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I feel really good about it. And I feel it's kind of like, you know, a culmination of my teaching. And I'm excited about all of it. I'm excited about the workshops, the consultations. But this mentoring thing, it's the first time I'm going to be doing it. I think it's going to work. And that's going to be very exciting. It's there for you at the wilsonwritingworkshop.com if you want to take a look at it. My classes are fun. There's always a lot of laughter, and that helps.
Yeah, it also sounds like very, very rewarding as well from you, like, because seeing them succeed feels like you're succeeding at all, which is has to be an amazing feeling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. But you know what happens when you're teaching in like a university setting or I've done a lot of seminars and weekend workshops and like that. You never stick with a writer. They're on to the next teacher, you know, when the 10 weeks are up, the 12 weeks. I've had a couple of students along the way who I really thought if I could just hang in there with them, I could really help them get that script. That's going to get them a career. So now's the time. I'm going to try it.
Yeah, no, it's very, very interesting at all. Definitely some lucky students. Yeah,
for real. Yeah. It's cool. Like what you're saying about how you're actually teaching from a place of success and experience. And I feel like across Hollywood, across a lot of different disciplines like that, there are a lot of teachers that don't really have success. I don't want to say they're grifting, but they found kind of success in teaching rather than in actually like doing the craft. I used to teach as well. Like one thing that I always loved through teaching, like your depth of understanding of the material is really increased. I was wondering if was there anything that you learned about yourself with your own writing or about writing in general that you wouldn't have been able to learn without teaching?
Oh my God, it happens all the time. I mean, it's why always and I'm doing it still. I mean, I'm writing screenplays 6 days a week, but it's always gone along with my teaching because I always say it keeps me honest. And what I mean by that is that trying to help students learn the process, it reminds me of what the process is. And I find that it spills into my writing all the time. I will have said something to a student that was maybe an insight about a scene of theirs. Well, you know, if you just flip this around, it would work better. Or, you know, and then I'll look at my own work and I'll go, oh yeah, just like what I said to my student, I can see this in my work.
Clicks.
Yeah, it clicks, and it's always fed each other. I'm so happy about that because teaching for me has never been a desperation move. You know, it's not because my screenwriting career has gone up in smoke. It's just always, you know, like I said, it's
passion.
Yeah, it's passion, and it's they've always worked very well together.
Like if you can pass that on, like you can probably affect generations of screenwriters and like actually move the entire medium along.
Well, you know, one writer at a time, and I hope so. And I'm not getting any younger, you know, and 30 plus is like a long time to have been doing this. And I do feel like now, and this is why this mentoring idea is so exciting to me, that I am ready now. I have the experience. I have the chops. I've lived a life that I can pass it on. And I am not cynical about storytelling and movie making at all. I am not cynical at all. And I think like I'm hardly the first person to say this, but right now in the world, like good stories and stories that bring people together and stories that entertain while huge air quotes educating. Yeah, I think it's critical.
We usually ask one last question from our guests. Any words of wisdom from someone like a writer looking to get into the industry that you wish you would have got when you first started out?
One thing that I always say to my students, when I started out, it was hard to make a movie. Just even the cost of film stock and renting cameras and all that, it could be done, but it was difficult. And now there is no excuse for not making a film because as he holds up his iPhone, you can make a really good movie on your phone if you're smart. and say to my students always, when I tell them that 95% of them will fail after I get through with that speech because they won't finish. And I will say, yes, write the movie, write the script that you hope you're going to sell for $1 million. And then you're going to get tied into the, you know, the Marvel franchise and be making money hand over fist. Of course, write that. But in the meantime, if you get really frustrated that your work can't be seen, that no one wants to make your movie, make your own movie. You know, I actually left teaching for a while because I was having an ethical dilemma about teaching. Because when people come into my classes, the thing that they really want to know, the bottom line of what they want to know is, how do I get a movie made? You've got movies made. How do I do it? And there was a time where I could spout the cliches. Well, if you write a good script, someone will find it. You know, if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. That kind of bullshit. You know, and but the answer was, you got me, and Beetlejuice is an iconic movie. I mean, I've done a lot of good work. It's the movie I'm going to be remembered for, thank God. But I didn't have an answer. And it really started bothering me teaching to the point where I left it behind for a couple of years. But then with the digital revolution, I came back to it because you can make a movie now. You just can. And there are so many people have given me so many excuses why they can't make a movie on their phone or, you know, for $5,000 or whatever. But I don't want to hear it because it's just not true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the inspiration, that you no longer are beholden to a system. You're no longer beholden to a technology. You can figure it out, you know, and wasn't it the Stranger Things guys, you know, that incredibly successful, what I think is a really wonderful franchise. I believe they were like making movies on YouTube, and that's how they were discovered.
That's really cool. We've had so many people on here that's what they're doing. They're making their own way. They're starting their own production companies. They're making their own scripts. They're writing their own things. And like, that's what they're doing until you get discovered through that, you know?
Yeah. And what a great way to get discovered. And also having directed, having made some movies, there is no more useless document than an unproduced screenplay. And that doesn't have to be the case anymore.
Between the internet and YouTube and all that, it's just changed everything, which is good because I feel like no one would ever read my script, like realistically, but like I can make my own movie and get it out there and people could see it and be on Instagram or TikTok or whatever.
Yeah. And then you don't know what's going to happen from there. Yeah, you don't know.
It's really cool when the barrier of entry gets lowered. We get access to a lot more ideas because there's a lot more perspectives that wouldn't have been in a particular place to get something made.
Yeah, because a lot of like, execs and all, like it usually comes down to dollars at the end of the day. They don't really care about the creative process. They don't really care about the creative endeavor. It's how much money is this movie going to make, or like would this movie like make us money or lose money? And that's so much stuff falls through the cracks because of that, because there's a lot of really good ideas out there.
Yeah, you know, and that was always the joy of horror movies for me, that you could, you know, because they were always sort of that cheap outlaw movie that you know, people in power shunned, but a lot of great filmmakers came out of the genre. But now it's basically any genre that you want to work in, anything you want to do. And again, sell the script for as much money as you can get, make that big movie. But you can do it on the cheap and you can do it for yourself. And the real joy is getting a movie made.
Yeah.
And you owe yourself that experience if you're a screenwriter.
For sure. Larry, it's been an absolute blast having you on our podcast tonight. It was absolutely awesome.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really fun. I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, you talked just the right amount.
Just the right amount. Yeah.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. It's been great. Really appreciate your insight. Appreciate your passion. I'm looking forward to the people that you inspire making cool things, you know, through your teaching and everything.
Yeah,
you're still writing, you know. So like, there's still more projects out there, which is awesome. And also,
yeah. So thank you. The Wilson Workshop. Come on down. All contributions gratefully accepted. And thank you guys. This was wonderful. Thank you so much. Yeah,
absolutely.
We definitely appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you. All right.
Have a good one. Oh, man.
That was fucking cool, dude.
So great. It's one of those things. It actually annoys me that I wish we had another 3 hours to talk to him.
Yeah.
I wanted to just talk. I had so many Beetlejuice questions, so many questions about the Addams Family. Like, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, like, that's such a foundation of like everything I love and all, like, of just, I feel like those movies are such big parts of our childhood to some extent, and it like shaped like other movies and other shows, and like it just kind of like it blew up the world, man. Like Beetlejuice is such a cult classic that is a movie like on paper probably shouldn't really work. I mean, it would definitely not work nowadays. And it's just so weird and quirky, and it's not really a kid's movie, and it's not really a horror spooky movie. It's just such a weird fucking movie. But like so many things are based on that, and like as a pop culture, like everyone says Beetlejuice, like it's just a pop culture thing. It just kind of like shaped a lot of things, and we got to talk to him tonight. That's yeah, so fucking cool.
Yeah, it was. I love what he's doing with the teaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's really cool to see somebody, because like even his experience is really cool, because he started out just like reading a bunch of scripts.
Yeah.
So he got to see scripts from all over the place. He got to see bad scripts, good scripts, mediocre scripts. He got that analyst, and then he got into a place where he was choosing which stories were going to get greenlit, or at least putting them up so they could get greenlit.
Or putting them in front of the right people to approve it.
Right. And after all of that, he becomes a screenwriter. And he does that successfully for many years. And then he starts teaching, you know, and then so he's got even more depth than that. He has a crisis of faith with teaching, and he goes away from that again. And then he comes back with like even more wisdom there. So I think that's a really cool arc. He probably has like a much more depth of perspective than other people that might be in that same industry.
No, 100%. And like if I had to choose between like him or some random guy that's like a failed screenwriter, like that's like what he said, like he wasn't trying to be like an asshole about it. That's the kind of person you want to learn from, because like he's seen so many different aspects of it. Not even just like obviously like his movies speak for himself and stuff like that, but just like you said, starting as like that analyst and like working his way up from there to an executive, and then like kind of circling back the creative aspect of it and all, like that's just that's the person you want teaching you. And like you have the passion, like he wants to mentor like the next generation. If I wanted to be into screenwriting, like I would 100% just sign up for his class.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would be awesome.
I mean, yeah, it sounds like a cool experience just to like understand that experience on a deeper level. Like what I love too is that, you know, maybe this will inspire these younger people to kind of go through a similar experience and then teach people that are coming up again, you know, so you kind of get this like acceleration of ability, you know, amongst like everybody that's in that realm, which I think that would be really cool. This is happening across a lot of different things in Hollywood. Or just in entertainment where there's not really this like scarcity that there used to be,
or it's not like the gatekeeping and the
right.
Like nothing's being inhibited anymore. Like
there's a lot more for everybody, so like I don't think things are as cutthroat. So like
oh, they're still cutthroat.
Well, no, I'm saying,
but there's more opportunity for stuff like, that's not mainstream that? Or like.
I mostly consume comedy in this realm, but so I've seen that a lot there too, where like comedians actually helping each other get better. Mm-hmm. They help each other come up. Like when somebody gets help like that, they want to help the next person as well. Yeah. You know, so you get this like culture of success, you get this culture of mentorship, and like it moves the medium along. You know what I mean?
I know I've talked about this before, but the Go-Giver, like the whole point of that self-help book is basically like the more you give to someone else, the more they get kind of give back to you and all. And not just like he says, like kind of like that symbiotic relationship, whereas like the teaching like taught him like, oh, let's look at it this way, or let's flip it this way. Everything you do to help people like kind of like pays it back to you in some way. And like just not being like a dick about it. And like just like most of the successful people like in any industry across the board, it's usually mentorship is one of the keyest aspects of like training that next generation. Absolutely. Or like showing someone the ropes or giving someone that opportunity. Like even like he said, like the cue card guy, like gave him the opportunity to get his foot in the door in the entertainment industry. And that's all it takes for some people. It's just that initial person just believing in them, showing them like some cool shit along the way. And so they can go forward. And that's how people become successful. And then they trickle it down.
I think that's kind of been known in management for over 100 years.
Yeah,
I don't remember when that was, but like I remember that there was a time when they if somebody's like productivity increased by too much, they would be called into the office and they'd be like they would get fired, because if you could have worked this much now, you could have always been working that much. So you've been a problem up until this point. You know, like it was a very strange way of thinking, but like there was kind of that discovery with management that if you treat people like people, like they're more productive. And so like that's kind of been a string in management for a long time. Like in Hollywood, I feel like it's just now like people are kind of understanding that's the way the thing works. It's more like tribal living. That's what it would be like living in a village. You know what I mean? Like you got to teach everybody, you got to pass on the knowledge.
Yeah. I think Hollywood's definitely a little bit, it does have that cutthroat mentality of it. And like we see it like not just like writers and stuff, but like people working like special effects and visual effects and all, like there's only so many like people that can do these type of jobs. There's only so much work available to them. So like it is one of those things where it is fairly cutthroat. And
There is a lot more work available now, though, I think, than there ever has been.
For sure.
And like people can make their own way too.
Mm-hmm.
because you can garner your own audience. Like if you're making something good, you can get an audience if you can get in front of people.
I think they did like a poll of like kids like in high school, and like majority of them did say they wanted to get in the entertainment industry in some capacity. Like it's the most prevalent, like people just want to like be part of it in any way. And so just because there's more availability, but I feel like at the same time, there's probably more demand of people wanting to get into it.
Influencers and all that.
Yeah. Cause you can like start off with TikTok or Instagram and then like, wow, this is really working out. This, maybe I turn this into like a late night television show, or maybe I turn this into like whatever project. And also like there's more availability for it, but there's more desire and there's more demand for it. And even from like a work perspective, because there's like no one works in factories anymore. The biggest export of the United States is entertainment and all. So like that's our number one export at this point. And like that's all people want to do. I mean, like I secretly want to be part of the entertainment industry in some capacity, but like, it's just like, fuck you.
In the US, like the main currency is attention. It seems like everybody kind of wants a little bit of fame. Everybody wants to be a little famous. Everyone. I don't really want that. They want to blow up on TikTok. They want to become viral. It's a little strange, but that's kind of the economy we're going into. It's like a currency of attention.
Yeah, no, for sure. One other last thing about Larry was the Cameron thing. I think that was what you were trying to tell me that you discovered. Yeah, I'm really glad you didn't ruin that for me, because that was way fucking cooler him telling it from the get-go than if you would have just like told me like, oh, you discovered Cameron. So cool. It reminded me a lot like Rob Berman.
Yeah.
The same attitude and all, because Rob's also a teacher as well. And also, I guess
it came up with horror.
You know? Yeah, in the same time frame as well. And like, it's funny, like, I don't know if you remember, but like Rob's family worked on like the werewolf movies, like Universal Monster. And so like that Dynasty. Plays a part in that plays a part in Larry's fascination and love of it. So it's like, it's cool to see that kind of thing.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Are you ever going to write that screenplay?
Maybe if I sign up for Larry's
You should do that. Just do that.
I don't, honestly, I would like to sign up just to hear stories about Beetlejuice. Like if he has his entire class on Beetlejuice, like fucking it.
Thank you all for listening. If you would like to support the WWSD podcast, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/WWSD_podcast. Make sure you like and subscribe on our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
You know, this is going to sound so fucking pretentious, but what really is, because, you know, I wanted to look at Masterclass and see what that was about. And Aaron Sorkin can write Rings Around Me in His Sleep. Okay. He's one of the great American writers. I watched his screenwriting Masterclass. I teach better than that on a bad day. It's not the same thing. It's just not. And then, you know, David Mamet has a class on there and he's just so gruff and he's going to tell you, listen, kid, I'm from Chicago and I punch people and, you know, and fuck you. You know what I mean? The one that I actually was so happy that it was good and it has good supporting materials, Neil Gaiman, you know, who is like my, you know, if I could be anyone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.